Good morning and welcome to this Bible study on the book of James. Hold tight while everyone arrives and we'll get going.
Can you hear me?
I can. How are you doing, Jeanette?
Good. How can you not be good? The sun is shining.
It is lovely, isn't it?
Yes. It kind of helps your spirit, your feeling, you know, your morale.
Definitely.
How you doing, Sue?
Good.
By the way, is my audio better?
Oh, much.
Clear? Is it clear?
Yes.
It is. Okay, Sue, great. I love your shirt.
Oh, thank you. I got very upset with all the book banning and I went on a splurge.
Oh, yeah.
I don't ever shop online. I bought 8 t-shirts about book banning and gave them for Valentine's.
Fantastic.
Yeah. That is scary when there's talk like that. That's, you know,
it's nothing new.
Yeah.
Oh, geez. Nothing new, but it is scary. Yes. And I actually know a couple librarians that went to jail for a few hours at a time right here in Erie County.
Wow.
Over banned books in high schools.
In what way? What happened?
Well, they refused to take them off the shelves.
Oh, okay. They were protecting the good.
Yeah.
Hurrah for civil disobedience.
Yes.
I agree. Librarians.
Yep. Good people.
Oh, Donna, the conversations you walk into.
I caught the gist of that one. I
it's
had the video, but my audio wasn't quite on yet. So, but I got it with the books removal from the shelves. I agree.
Yeah. It's started it with my new t-shirt.
Yeah, we go.
Make Orwell fiction again. It would be nice, wouldn't it? That was my thought too when I heard it. I said it's like 1984 or something.
Yeah.
The Orwellian thing. That's true. It's getting scary.
All right. Well, it looks like this may be it for now. Oh, nope. Here comes Grace.
Oh, good.
So we are looking at James chapter 3, right? Chapter 3. Okay, great. Does anyone have any leftover questions from our previous conversations about James chapter 1 and chapter 2? All right, we're all hanging tight, that's cool. Then, can I ask for a volunteer to read to us James chapter 3?
Well, I missed the last meeting, so I'll fess up and do it.
All right, do it, Don.
Not many of you should become my brother. For you know that
we will be judged. We can't hear you, Donna.
Yeah, Donna.
We can only hear you when you face the microphone.
Well, let me move my book.
Okay,
we'll try it again.
All right.
Not many of you, are you getting it? They're coming through all right now? Not many of you should become teachers, my brothers and sisters, for you know that we who teach will be judged with greater strictness. For all of us make many mistakes. Anyone who makes no mistakes in speaking is perfect, able to keep the whole body in check with a bridle. If we put bits into the mouths of horses to make them obey, we guide their whole bodies. Or look at ships. Though they are so large that it takes strong winds to drive them, yet they are guided by a very small rudder, wherever the will of the pilot directs. So also the tongue is a small member, yet it boasts of great exploits. How great a forest is set ablaze by a small fire, and the tongue is a fire. The tongue is placed among our members as a world of iniquity. It stains the whole body, sets on fire the cycle of nature, and is in itself set on fire by hell. For every species of beast and bird, of reptile and sea creature, can be tamed and has been tamed by the human species, but no one can tame the tongue, a restless evil full of deadly poison. With it we bless the Lord and Father, and with it we curse those who are made in the likeness of God. From the same mouth come blessing and cursing. My brothers and sisters, this ought not to be. This ought not to be so. Does a spring pour forth from the same opening both fresh and brackish water? Can a fig tree, my brother and sisters, yield olives, or a grapevine figs? No more can salt water yield fresh. You who is wise and understanding among you, who is wise and understanding among you, show by your good life that your works are done with gentleness, born of wisdom. But if you have bitter envy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not be boastful and false to the truth. Such wisdom does not come down from above, but is earthly, unspiritual, devilish. For where there is envy and selfish ambition, there will also be disorder and wickedness of every kind. But the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, without a trace of partiality or hypocrisy. And a harvest of righteousness is sown in peace for those who make a peace. That's
it. Thank you, Donna. Let's let that sink in for a couple of moments in quiet, and then I will bring us out of the silence. What do you notice in chapter 3?
A lot of wisdom. James is very good at capturing very personal things that are that you really don't think about that are so important, like the tongue. And that's so true. You have to think first before you say things and make sure that you're not going to hurt somebody, or you don't want to just off the cuff say something that might be harmful or hurtful to other people. I mean, you're so right about the tongue.
What do you guys think about Jeanette's thought?
Well, that's kind of,
well,
the gist of it, I think. Isn't it? It is for me, anyways. Yeah. Be thoughtful, be patient, be kind before you open your mouth.
Yeah, right.
Kind of the,
you have to be considerate.
Yeah, but in order to do that, I think you have to love. You have to care whether you're hurting somebody else or not.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah. I come down in a slightly different place. I'm not disagreeing outright. And there are a lot of points that you make that I can agree to. I am an external processor. I don't know if you're familiar with that term.
Nope.
An external processor is someone who has a hard time thinking in their own head.
Say again, hard time doing what?
A hard time thinking in their own head.
Oh, okay.
And so, being an introvert and an external processor, for a long time, I would have to sit in meetings and write. I would have to write all during the meeting, not just to take notes on the meeting, but to figure out what I was thinking about what people were saying. Because I have a hard time processing it inside. So when someone tells me to think before I speak, that's not always helpful advice for me. Because sometimes, most of the time, in order for me to think, I have to speak. This can get very confusing. If I'm talking about something that I'm dreaming of or imagining, because, well, I can be also very convincing when I speak. And I know that that is a power I have to use for good and not evil, which is part of James's point, I think. And I can say I'm talking to my husband. I can tell him about all the things I'd like to do to a room in our house and the changes that I'd like to make. Maybe the upgrades, maybe get rid of some furniture. Donna knows I have a problem with too much furniture in space. Yes, I do. It's a historical issue. And I can say all of these things, but I'm thinking them. I'm thinking about, would it be nice to have this over here and that over there and a new over here and a different over here, and maybe I'll recover that and maybe I'll do this. But when I'm saying it, it sounds to him like I'm about to do it. But I'm just thinking about it. And so in our communications, I have to be clear to him, these are just thoughts I'm having, and I'm having them out loud. This is not a plan. This is not something you have to agree to right now. And you don't have to be able to imagine it like I can imagine it. So that's one tricky thing. And it's one thing if you're talking about, you know, reorganizing or redecorating a room. It's another thing if you're talking about like significant life plans. For me, the thing that substitutes for think before you speak, Sarah, is what Sue was touching on about having love in your heart to begin with. That's about half the battle for me. So I know that if I can speak when I'm not angry, because we each have an issue in our lives and wrath is mine, I'm gonna own it. But if I can speak without being angry, then I can go to that place where I have love and compassion in my heart for just about everybody I encounter. And what comes out is better. The other half of that for me is about being incredibly present in the moment. Not distracted, not looking at my phone, not thinking about other things. When you guys are talking, I am here with you. And I know that's not a really super popular thing for people my age and younger to engage in, a total present-mindedness during a conversation. But it's the only way that I can engage with you or anyone in a genuine and loving manner. And, you know, spiritually, we could talk about the discernment of the Holy Spirit as I'm talking and as I'm offering pastoral advice or just a listening ear or biblical inquiry like this, any of those things that I do professionally. But I also have to do this outside of my professional life, because this is the way, as someone who really can't think before she speaks, because the speaking is an inherent part of the thinking, this is how I manage to put a bridle on my tongue, as James would put it. And if I don't do that, then I have to go back to that place where I write throughout a meeting, which, you know, seems weird to other people because it looks like I'm not paying attention. In fact, I'm thinking very hard about what they're saying. I just can't think inside my own noggin. So some people are not like this. Some people are internal processors. And to a very small extent, I can do that. I can stare at a wall and dream my happy dreams and have conversations with characters in my head. But it only works when I'm storytelling to myself. It doesn't work when I'm interacting with other people. So
that sounds unusual, but actually, if your husband and family, it seems like it would be good that they know what you're thinking about, and, you know, different things you're considering, if they know you do that. You know?
You know, I don't know what percentage of the population are external processors. I don't. But I know that if an external processor doesn't realize that that's who they are and how they work, it can make their life very difficult. And for a long time in my professional life, before I felt confident and safe and feeling like I had something to contribute to the world, you know, when I was still a young priest and suffering from imposter syndrome, I couldn't be this present-minded. And I couldn't speak with any kind of authority. And I didn't have the nerve to speak like I can speak now because of the external processing. And so I would be the quiet assistant priest scribbling during the meeting. And then finally, at the end, bust out with something really interesting. Hi, because I had been thinking all the time. But I'd have to literally read it off the sheet that I had written it from. But just because external processors exist in the world doesn't mean that people know that's how they are. They might just think that they're strange or not very intelligent or can't control their tongue. And so there's this other way.
Even as an external processor, as you call yourself, what you finally come down to, though, is you have to go to that loving place in yourself. And I think that's kind of what it's about. When you can do it without having to write it down, you're using that loving space as a filter.
Yes.
And so am I. That's what I mean by saying.
Right.
Only the difference is you have more processes to go through to get there, perhaps, than I do. You know what Maybe. I mean? Well, I mean, when you're talking about having to write it and process it in a different way, you know, right. kind of thing. But I think it's a matter of kindness and love that teaches us when to close our mouths and just listen. And, you know.
I think your point about being in the moment is we should all do that. You know, be more in the moment and conscious and thinking about who we're talking to and what we're talking about. And, you know, instead of just kind of with just half our minds, you know, when we're distracted by other things. You know, I think all of us should do that more often, you know, to be in the moment, very conscious of who we're talking to and what we're talking
about. My mother had a simple thing. If you can't say anything nice about anybody, don't say anything at all.
That was my mother had the same saying.
Did she? Mother's wisdom is pretty good most of the time.
She was on to something.
Don't listen to it.
Unfortunately, sometimes she did refrain from saying things that would have been useful for me to know.
Yes.
Sue, you look like you've got something to say over there.
No, my mother said the same thing, and I agree with you totally. As I look back on life, I think, well, why didn't she say something?
Right.
Yep. That's why.
So some, you know, you have to weigh your thoughts, your speech, and your reactions.
Yes, of course you do. And sometimes you have to stand up for yourself or whatever idea you're trying to support.
Like right.
your librarian friend. Who had to go to jail. She may not, her actions spoke louder than her words, but she said, you know, no, this isn't right.
Right. What else jumps out at you from chapter 3?
That verse 3, that if you put bits in the mouths of horses, you're guiding their whole body. That's something I never would have realized. I'm not a horse person. So I wouldn't have put those two ideas together.
So you're not a horse person, so I'll explain it real quick. The structure of a horse's jaw, you know, is much longer than ours. And they've got a space right about here where they don't have any teeth. They've got teeth behind it and they've got teeth in front of it. But right here, They don't have any teeth on each side. And so when the bit goes in their mouth, it goes on top of their tongue and it rests in a place that's comfortable for them. And it goes in that space that doesn't have any teeth. But imagine having an iron or steel piece of metal resting on your gums and on the back of your tongue. And so when the bit, you know, and it's attached to the reins, when the reins ever so slightly pull this way, the horse is really clear that you want to go that way. Same thing with that. And when you pull back all the way, all of a sudden the horse's head is like, whoa, okay, we'll stop. And if you pull back too hard, the horse will rear. And if you're just not a very nice person, horses aren't very smart, but they're emotionally intelligent. They're very emotionally intelligent. And so the horse will just play tricks on you. The horse, if you don't get the bit in right, it'll spit it out. And if you're not paying attention while you're putting the saddle on, the horse will swallow several lungfuls of air into its belly to make it rounder so that when you put the saddle on, okay, yeah, it's nice and tight. And then as the horse walks, it'll let go of the air in its stomach and the saddle will circle round and hang underneath the horse. And meanwhile, you're way the hell back there because you fell off. Now, these are just two of the infamous tricks that horses can do. And the whole point is that the horse doesn't necessarily want to pay attention to you. The horse doesn't necessarily want to carry you. The horse may not think very much of you, actually, but you can still control the horse with a bit and a bridle. And some horses don't even need the bit inside the bridle. You can just have a looser thing kind of around this portion of their face that is very comfortable to them without putting something in their mouth. And some horses are so sick of human beings and their mouth is so tough, they can't feel what you want and they don't care. But that's kind of the universe in which this metaphor is being used. And especially with people who are perhaps not particularly compassionate to anyone, much less a horse. They perhaps don't treat their horses very well. And they perhaps have a horse that doesn't really want to deal with them. And so the bit is very important. And it makes me think of how we can be in internal conflict within ourselves. It's like Donna and Jeanette were commenting about the present-mindedness. You know, if I as a human being am not being present in a conversation, and, you know, I was actually trained in it because I have a master's in social work. And so one of the things they teach you on is this kind of deep present-mindedness when you are listening to, say, a client. But if I have divided attention, whether it's a cell phone or whether I'm just worried about something and I'm preoccupied and I can't seem to let it go in order to have this conversation here, I'm like the horse that doesn't want to go on this ride, that doesn't want to carry you from point A to point B, even though my thoughts are like, no, we have to have this conversation. It is time for Bible study. Open up Zoom. But if my heart is in a different place, and that is a kind of innocuous example, but of course it can get much uglier than that. When the stuff that we're feeling inside is really dark and maybe pretty ugly. And whether it's the fact that we are deeply grieving some tragedy of our lives, or we are filled with hatred and we cannot overcome it in this moment. Thinking about those larger concerns and the idea of the deep kind of prejudice that was present in these first century communities. And it wasn't necessarily racial prejudice. It was social prejudice. It was socioeconomic prejudice. It was like national and cultural prejudices. And that was very, very real. And so people were agreeing that they love Jesus and agreeing that they wanted to worship in this place. And there's only one church in this city. There's only one group of Christians. And so now you have to associate with all these people that you don't like and you don't think are inherently as equal as you are. And James is asking you to hold your tongue. Ouch.
Yes.
Interesting.
The other, but at that time, and it still exists to a large extent in our world, is sort of tribalism, where, you know, there was all this interaction. We go raid this place, steal people, make slaves out of them, vice versa. And it keeps going round and round and round. And it still exists to a very great extent, even now, with when you look at the map of the world and all the little communities, that kind of speaks volumes to me, that you have a little teeny weeny nation that can't protect itself, but will fight for its right to exist because of tribalism, for lack of a better word. And, you know, I think that that must have been extremely difficult for early Christians to get over. But, you know, like in the Bible, the Samaritans are no-nos, you know, we don't mess with Samaritans at all. We don't want anything to do with them. And of course, that flies in the face of the message of Christ, doesn't it? He would talk to a Samaritan.
Right.
Nobody else would.
Right. What do you guys think about this idea of bringing in tribalism?
It just seems very, very much where we're at today. So it seems like it has always been part of human nature, this weak spot. And yet at the same time, it's the cohesive part of a culture. It's the piece that kind of glues people together to care.
You need to belong.
Right.
Yin and a yang.
Mm-hmm. There's a problem today. I think the wisdom piece in here too is very interesting. I think the wisdom of God being peaceful and loving and good stuff like that. I don't know. Sometimes I think we think we're wise. Maybe we aren't so wise. We think we're wise because we're educated or we're this or we're that, and we think we have the answers. More often than not, we don't. Not the big questions, anyway.
Jeanette, what were you going to say?
I was going to say, in our culture, we need, like Donna was saying, you know, the tribalism is a factor, you know. I mean, just because, you know, you've got different people of different cultures and different races and stuff like that within, you know, like the United States, you know. I mean, you have to learn how to get along with each other and love one another, you know. So it's an issue right here in our own country at the present time.
One of the things that Donna had said, when you're talking about the different kinds of wisdom, and you know, this is the portion that starts at at verse 13, but I am looking very specifically. Let me find it. I am looking at the middle of verse 17, where he says, full of mercy. And anytime I see the actual word mercy mentioned in the New Testament, I am reminded that the Roman Empire did not have the concept of mercy. And if that isn't something in the forefront of your mind, I want to bring it back. They had the concept of clemency, which is a pardon because someone has usefulness. So they might pardon a soldier, because that soldier still has usefulness. And so they offer clemency, but they don't pardon the soldier out of a sense of mercy. When Pontius Pilate was offering to pardon one of the convicts for the Passover. It was a political act to get in good and to, you know, keep the waves small with the nation he was governing. It wasn't out of the kindness of his heart. And it wasn't because he embraced mercy as a concept. And despite the fact that the passion plays out the way we've got it in those gospels, it wasn't a merciful act on Pilate's part. It was a political act. And so when I hear New Testament writers and Jesus encouraging people to be merciful to one another, we need to remember that that is a concept that comes firmly from our Hebrew spiritual heritage. The idea of God being merciful, that is not something from Greek philosophy, friends. That is not something that would have been normal to a Roman citizen. And in that way, you know, the Roman Empire gives us lots and lots and lots of things. And it is the foundation of Western civilization. And also, morally, it wasn't entirely bankrupt. But comparing it morally to the Jewish religion, even though the Jewish religion had to deal with corruption and had to deal with all kinds of craziness, and they were collaborators with Rome, the upper echelons of the priestly orders, even considering all of that, the Jewish religion, the ancient Jewish religion, absolutely understood a deep and compassionate morality way better than the Romans. So I put that to you, friends. Sue?
Is that developing that kind of a philosophical idea in a time frame where it doesn't naturally exist, the whole empathy thing?
Well, see, and that's the thing. Like the Greek philosophers were figuring out empathy. But the Jewish people have been receiving instruction from God on empathy since the commandments came down and they tried to figure out why they were important. Because everything in the Ten Commandments can be traced back to a deeper empathy for your neighbors. You know, you've got the stuff that concerns God, but then after the commandments that have to do with God, then you've got the intensely personal ones and all the commandments that have to do with what you should not do to your next door neighbor. And then when we see in Leviticus, it's more than just your next door neighbor. It's your next door neighbor. It's the stranger sojourning in your land. So it's whoever shows up. Doesn't matter what nationality they are, doesn't matter what God they worship, they are still subject to the empathy of our laws. And then, you know, in the deeper laws of Leviticus, because there are so many laws in Leviticus.
There are a lot of laws.
You know, if you look at just the kosher laws, one of the beautiful aspects of keeping kosher is there's a reason you don't serve meat and cheese together. You don't serve meat and dairy together. Because it is inherently cruel to boil a kid in its mother's milk. I mean, that's like the deep midrash understanding of why you don't eat meat and dairy together. Because it's heartless to eat something that is from the milk of the mother and then also the child together. I mean, riddle me that, Batman. That thinks a lot, that goes a lot deeper into our food choices than most of us go, I think. I mean, I'm still here for the bacon cheeseburgers. So, you know, it doesn't inform my thinking that much, but.
And we eat eggs.
And, you know, people who are vegetarian and people who are vegan, not everybody, some people do it for their health, some people do it for other benefits, but some people do it for a deeply moral and compassionate reason. Mm-hmm. And it's got nothing to do with their health. They do it because it actually horrifies them.
I have a daughter-in-law like that.
I have a friend who won't eat anything with eyes. Fish. I can't look them in the eye.
A lot of veggies and fruit.
I always tease her about potatoes having eyes, but they're not the kind that work. So she can get by that.
Right. And, you know, in our culture, I mean, Donna's words aside, because that is a funny joke. You know, in our culture, it is still socially appropriate to tease and mock, at least in some respects, people who make that particular moral choice.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting thing to tease and mock just because we're not making that moral choice, or just because we've thought about the morality of it and we're still okay. And, you know, here I am. I'm a meat eater. I don't make that moral choice. But I'm not quite sure it's a good idea to mock someone who has different morals than I have and has decided to reorganize their life on the basis of those morals. Because Lord knows I've reorganized my life on the basis of the morals that I do have.
And we all do that, whether we think about it or we don't think about it. It's just kind of a coexisting circumstance. Mm-hmm.
Brings up a good point, Sue. We should think more about what we do and why we do it. And it goes back to what Marilyn was talking about last week, I think. You know, our actions, you know, demonstrate what we believe in, you know, and we should think more, a little bit more about. And another thing, I think it's in James, but it's probably the next chapter about. Doing what you believe in and think it's along those lines, thinking more about why you're doing them and being more thoughtful about what you're doing, and the fact that not doing something. Oh yeah, it's something to do. I think it's at the end of the next chapter. It's something to do with. If you don't do something that you should be doing, it's a sin. You know, like if there's a poor person that you should be giving food to or something like that, if you turn your back on a situation like that, that's a sin, you know, to not do something when it's called upon, you know, and that's kind of scary.
Yeah, to not care.
Yeah. I mean, the fact that you're sinning by just not doing something because you're not thinking, you know, about doing it, and, you know.
That prayer, the things done and the things left undone.
That's right. What is that in now? That's in one of the prayers or the creeds? Yeah.
It's in one of the prayers of the Mass.
Right. It's in the Mass every week, right?
Mm-hmm. It's part of the
things done and left undone, something like that, right?
It's part of the confession.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So much of what we say to other people is really based on our judgmentalism.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to think about that. Why did you say that? It doesn't really affect you. It doesn't matter. And it was hurtful.
Yeah.
And it was judgmental.
Mm-hmm.
And if you get over the judgmental part, there are a lot of things you would not say.
Mm-hmm.
Even if they're
true. Marilyn, I think that is beautifully insightful.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I do as a spiritual director is help people to figure out, okay, why did I say that? like, what possessed me to say that thing that I look back on it now and I say, yep, that was hurtful. That was a barbed comment. It meant to wound, and I hit it a bullseye with this person that I care for. And, you know, to dig down deep and find out, what did possess me? What was there something unconscious going on? Am I in fact actually really angry or really resentful? And I don't want to acknowledge it. I don't want to own it. Or I'm so filled with worry that I don't want to admit to, that it's coloring everything I say. And, you know, counselors can do that. Therapists can do that. Good friends can do that. Spiritual directors can do that. It's that willingness to be courageously honest with ourselves about what might be inside that we don't want to admit to, which is a little bit like what we've been talking about being totally present and about having love as the center of our reaction. You know, when I can be totally present and really just bring my A game as concerns, responding with love, the percentage of time that I say entirely the wrong thing, it decreases sharply. Like it never hits zero, to be clear, but it decreases sharply because I've intentionally done that. Now, can I bring that to every moment of every day? Not yet. It's one of my spiritual practices. You know, it's kind of a living, moving meditation that I do when I'm not just sitting quietly in a meditation posture with, you know, I have minimized outside distractions. My husband is asleep. The cats are in another room and they're not allowed to come in. And there are no dogs that are barking and I've silenced my phone, you know. It's great to meditate or pray when no one's going to bother you. But if you can't pray and meditate on the fly, what are you going to do the other 23 and a half hours? Grace, you've been awfully quiet. You want to weigh in on this?
Well, I'm thinking that my tongue, I know I had to control my anger because that's when my tongue gets out of control. So I had to control my anger.
I feel you. Yeah. I feel you.
I think that's true for everybody. I think anger gets us, the tongue gets loose when you're angry.
Especially when it
passes ears.
Yeah. And you can't take it back.
No, you can't take it back. Once it's out, it's out. That's it. Do you think that there is, you made a point that there was no concept of mercy in the Roman Empire. Do you think that our world has a concept of mercy now?
That's a good question.
I look at things like genocide and what goes on in China, what goes on in our own nation. And I think, you know, is there really mercy? Like at home here, there's a lady on the news the other day who goes up to homeless people and she asks them if she can help them contact their family, and she reunites people. She just does it on her own, gets on the computer, gets names, and tries to put, like in the news piece, this mother who has been estranged from her child, who is an adult, for 15 years, living on the street, taking drugs. And her comment, which just hit home to my heart, they show this woman and she's sitting on the ground under a bridge with a blanket wrapped around her, looking just absolutely pathetic. And everybody just walks by and this lady can't. She said, mm-hmm. I just sat down next to her and asked her if I could help her. And I thought, we don't do that. We're afraid of extending ourselves to situations like that. I remember as a young person downtown Buffalo, and there was a guy, it was a nursing school, there was a guy laying in an entryway to a building. And I was with a group, and I went up to him, and I said, "Do you need help?" Now, this was a naive 18-year-old, right? Just following the heart kind of thing. But as I got older, I learned to walk by them.
Right. What do you guys think about Donna's reflections?
It's very real.
Part of the problem is it's so overwhelming. There's so many people, you know, in need of help, you know, especially in the inner cities, not so much in Clarence, you know. But and you feel you're such a tiny little cog, you know, in this big universe of problems that it's intimidating.
Sue, what were you going to say?
Well, I was thinking of two different ends of my life. I was thinking of when I was a little kid and my mother and I would be walking, probably with my brother and sister as well, walking down Bailey Avenue, and there on the corner of Kensington and Bailey, there was always a very decrepit, probably crippled man sitting on a blanket, and he had a cup with pencils in it. And I would look at him, and I probably stared at him. I was probably 7. And I remember my mother grabbing my hand and kind of moving us along and then saying, "You don't stare at people who hurt. You go and help them." And she gave us a nickel to go buy a pencil. And then my daughter was, when she was in her early 20s, was living right in New York City in Manhattan. And she was a newly minted physical therapist. And however she went to work, she always passed this group of cardboard boxes that people lived in. And she had apparently spoken to one of the residents, a woman, a couple of times, and just had a friendly good morning or hello sort of a thing. Mm-hmm. And one day it was really, really cold. And I know this because the woman eventually, when I happened to be in there walking with my daughter, came and grabbed my arm and told me. My daughter came with hot chocolate several mornings on her way to work. She got one for herself and one for the woman. They chatted a few minutes and then my daughter went on. And these are such simple, easy things to do, but we're so afraid to do them. We're so afraid. But what are we afraid of?
What do you think? What do you guys think? What are we afraid of?
Sometimes I wonder if we're afraid of being involved beyond the momentary situation more than we can handle, perhaps.
I think some of it too is insulation. If you live in Clarence, you don't see too many beggars on the street.
Right. So you stay in Clarence.
When I worked in the inner city, and was comfortable there. Now, I just got to tell you this. There was a lumber yard in Clarence Center, and I used to go over because I was always involved in some house project. And the guys were amazed that Marge and I went to Erie County Medical Center. You go into the city every day like it was, you know, do this kind of thing. And I said, "Well, yeah," or we'd be chatting. I'd say, "Well, we went down to the, you know, a concert, Klein Hands kind of thing." Mm-hmm. Don't venture out of your safe space, was the message I got. And we, of course, lived in the city. We lived over on the west side, had an apartment there for a while. And, you know, and I was raised in the city, so I wasn't intimidated by the city, but I found myself getting more and more removed from what happens in the city when we moved out to Clarence.
Yes, me too.
And so you become, I don't know, some kind of insulation goes up around you, and you're not as attuned
to, yes,
being merciful to a stranger who is different than you. They're others.
They're not. Let me throw out a piece of challenge for you that riffs on the insulation that Donna is talking about, but that is something that anyone in Clarence or Florida can still be mindful of and start to make decisions based in the ethics that they want to adopt. And that is how you purchase your clothes. It is an established fact that most of the clothes that are available for purchase at what most people would consider a reasonable price were made overseas, mm-hmm, in conditions that mimic the triangle shirt waist, mm-hmm, disaster.
Yeah.
And by conditions, I mean the working conditions and the pay scale and the age of the people involved,
yeah,
and the exploitative labor of the women and the children. Mm-hmm. That's what I mean by the working conditions of the triangle shirt waist factory fire. And most places that sell you clothes don't want to admit to it. And they don't want to tell you the conditions of their factories overseas.
But there's a reason they're so cheap.
There's a reason they're so cheap. And honestly, it's not a new problem. Yeah. This was true going back to the mid-1800s when sewing machines, before sewing machines were, mm-hmm, produced, when women and children at home in Western Europe were busting their eyes and breaking their fingers to make shirts and chemises, which were essentially the underclothing at the time, as quickly as possible, as cheaply as possible, so that people could have 20 or 30 of them.
And that's why we had slavery, to produce the cotton, to ship to England to make the cotton that the people, and that got sent back. So it was a constant circle, cotton, right, from us to England, then cotton fabrics back to us for the factories.
And I say this, and I think about the clothes I'm wearing right now. There's not a damn thing I'm wearing right now that I made. And I sew for a lot of different reasons. And one of the reasons I sew is because I don't like participating in fast fashion, which is what they call it. But you know, there's a couple of things to do if this particular moral inequity bothers you. One is to use your clothes until they die, which at least was the way I was raised. You use those jeans until there are holes in indecent places. Because if they're just holes in non-indecent places, you patch them.
Yeah.
But you use them till they die. And then maybe we cut them up for rags.
Yep.
And so, you know, that was how I was raised. It's easy to do. I just wear my clothes out.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think real hard before I acquire new clothes. And I think, is this something that I can afford to pay someone a living wage for? And I recently got a clergy shirt, a single clergy shirt, because that's all I could afford. Because the single clergy shirt cost $90.
Mm-hmm. And where was it made?
In the US.
Was it? Okay, good.
And it was made because I'm a large person to begin with, and I'm a woman. And so all the clergy shirts that, you know, if I want to buy a cheaper clergy shirt, I can do it. it's not going to fit particularly well, and it's going to have been made in a sweatshop overseas.
Yeah. Right.
And so, you know, I saved my pennies because $90 for a shirt is not what I like to spend. And I fully plan on wearing it till I die. And right now I have one clergy shirt. But then again, I don't need to wear a clergy shirt to every meeting I have all throughout the week. And in fact, you note I am not wearing a collar right now. Because I have nothing to prove to you.
Well, this whole idea, when we got involved with School 6, I felt for me, because I feel like Donna was saying, when I moved out to Lancaster years ago, the same kind of situation developed. And when we started going into School 6 to help out, it just seemed like, I have lost you. Are you guys there?
We can still hear you.
This is weird. I don't know how that happened. But
no, you haven't lost us.
Oh, we're still here. We still hear you.
So at any rate, I thought that was one example of how we could kind of reconnect with that feeling of not being so isolated and so insulated.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Marilyn, what were you going to say?
Oh, I had this memory that it just recurs so often. It's when I was in my early marriage years. I think I was still living in the city. It was probably around 1970 or whatever. But I think I was downtown shopping probably when we went downtown to go shopping, whatever. And a man came up and just asked me for a small amount of money. I think it was less than a dollar. It was probably like a quarter or something like that. And I didn't give it to him because I thought there are all kinds of people out here who are taking this money and going in and buying themselves something that they don't need, but just, it was sort of a principle, but I don't think it was a valid principle anymore. But I just didn't, and it was something that I could certainly have afforded to give him, but it was some principle that I thought I had. I didn't give it to him. And, you know, here I am like 50 years later and remembering that. And why didn't I just give it to him? Because it wouldn't have affected me in any way, one way or another. It was such a small amount to begin with. And when you give something like that anyway, that's, you've done your part, and what they do with it is their responsibility. If there is an accounting of it, you know. And I thought to not give something like that to somebody is, it's a crime. It's just a terrible thing to do. And I thought, you know, and this is all about, I don't know, a quarter or a half a dollar or whatever, something, nothing, you know, that would have meant anything in my life to part with. And I just didn't do it because I thought I was following some kind of principle. I don't know what.
Mm-hmm. Marilyn, your point is really valid because we have ethical debates,
yeah,
on whether or not it is a good idea to help someone when we deeply suspect they're going to use that for drugs or alcohol or some other vice that we don't personally approve of. And, you know, people come down on both sides.
There used to be, when I lived in Williamsville, there was a man that was homeless that used to roam the streets. I had, yeah, never seen him, but I had heard about him. And I know people used to take him in and let him shower and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But one day I was in the supermarket on Main Street in Williamsville, and I came out and he was standing there. And I was like, oh, I was on the mile, I was surprised, but he was standing there smoking. And the first thing that went through my head, well, you know what? If you can afford cigarettes, I don't need to give you any money. And then I think that was the wrong thought. I should have not thought that way. But it was the first thing that came right through my mind.
It brings us back to that judgmental statement that we were making earlier on, that we have these unconscious judgments that we make of people. and we make of our relationship to those people. And it's just kind of like a reflex action. We don't honestly concentrate on it. We just react judgmentally, unconsciously.
Thank you for joining me for this fantastic conversation today. I know it is already 11. It's hard to see how fast the time flies. I know. We will be here next week to look at James chapter 4. And in the meantime, I wanted to just put something out there for you if you're interested, and you might not be, so that's fine. Take it with a grain of salt. But I have started blogging regularly again. And so if anyone is interested in checking out my website, you can do that. It is sareliz.com, spelled just like this, S-A-R-E-L-I-Z.com. I have happily owned that domain for like 20 years, maybe more. And so, yeah, it's a warehouse of things I do and places I am on the internet. So enjoy.
Two things I want to tell you before we end. I have a question. Number one, Rose, how is she?
Oh, she's doing very well. Thank you. Good. She's back to work. She has very impressive scars and she, you know, she's keeping her spirits up.
We'll keep her on the prayer list then.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you very
Absolutely.
Much.
The other thing is I bought Atomic Habits.
Oh, have you started it yet?
I have.
Do you like it?
It's interesting. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It has a lot of stuff I've seen before in a different way, but it's good. I think it's a very interesting book.
Yeah. I
bought Jeanette it and then Sue. Jeanette?
I just wanted to ask, can you hear me as clearly as if I was in the same room with you?
Almost.
Yeah. Almost? Okay. Mm-hmm. But there's no static or breakup of the voice.
There is an occasional breakup of the voice, and it happens when you look down.
Okay.
And when you look to the side, okay. I think.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Sue?
I was just repeating what Donna said. I had also bought the book. I haven't had time to get into it.
That's okay. I hope you enjoy it.
Thank you.
All right. I'll see you guys later.
Bye. Have a good day.
Bye, everybody.